Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist. Today we have a special episode here on the 56th anniversary of the JFK assassination. We'll be joined by Dr. Joseph Farrell, who is focused on the NASA-Nazi connection to deep state power structures hidden inside covert programs. We'll follow the course of the deep state assault on the presidency from 1963 to the present, and we'll reveal breakthrough information on the activities of a fascist Black Project CIA front group called Permandex, first brought to public awareness by DA Jim Garrison, who was investigating aerospace military contractors that were responsible in his eyes for the assassination of President Kennedy. And we'll also go deep on DISC, or Defense Industrial Security Command, headed up by paperclip Nazi scientist Wernher von Braun. Here we go. Dr. Joseph Farrell, Permandex, Assassination Incorporated. Joseph, it's great to see you.
Good to see you, Daniel.
It's fantastic to have you back on the show. And of course, we are here on the 56th anniversary of the JFK assassination. And 56 years, still no resolution of it. And of course, incredible denials throughout the media in the United States. Now, we've seen them use just about every trick in the book to keep the truth on this down. But a number of researchers have broken a lot of details in this case that I think give us a much better picture of the impact just of what was happening there. It's much larger than any kind of Cuban mafia.
Oh, yeah.
That's the secondary cover stories, as we call it. And I, you know, when I look at the case, I rank books like Professor Scott's book on the deep state, deep politics and JFK. But your book is right up there because it is LBJ and the conspiracy to kill Kennedy, a coalescence of interests. And in a sense, the coalescence of interests is the heart of this book. It brings it all together. Can you tell me what you were thinking when you were pulling that title together, Coalescence of Interests?
Well, look, I'm kind of like you. I've been fascinated with the Kennedy assassination since I was a boy. I was alive when it happened, and I was homesick from school, so I was literally watching it happen. And, you know, it has an impact on a boy when you're 6 years old, and all of a sudden the president's dead, and the story they're concocting doesn't even make sense to a six-year-old. And that, you know, and I had my dad's rumblings in the background all through that whole period, and it never made sense to me. So I've always been interested in it, and in reading it, you know, I've got gobs of books on my shelves about the Kennedy assassination, and you know, I've read pretty much everybody that there is to read about, you know, Grodin and what's his name, Epstein, the guy that did the Oswald book, and you know, I've read pretty much all the major studies. And the thing that struck me about all of them is that they all take a particular faction that they want to see as being, you know, the faction in control of it, be it the mob, the anti-Castro Cubans, the CIA, and what have you. And I never looked at it that way. To me, it just seemed like that pretty much everybody was involved at some level. And, you know, that they were out to get this guy no matter what. And you've got banking interests involved. You've got deep interests inside the Pentagon. You've got the intelligence complex. So, I literally did look at it as a coalescence of interests. And to me, that's the thing that makes the most sense out of it. It's not saying everybody else is wrong. It's what it's really saying is everybody's kind of partly right, you know, that has investigated it. So that's how the book came about. And it, the other part of it is, I think I've said this before, is I got a call from David Childress one day and said that he had to get this book on the Kennedy assassination out. And the author he had lined up was had dropped out of the project, and he needed it done with a within a month. Could I do it? So I scrambled to try and get that thing done.
It's good you had the background. The case to be able to do that. And it's amazing that you could turn it over so quickly.
Yeah, it was about 2 weeks of fast and furious typing, literally. It was my fingers were down to bloody stumps by the end of that period. But it really does strike me as an event of the deep state in all of its ramifications and all of its factions, and including up to, and in my opinion, definitely including Lyndon Johnson. I don't see how you can escape the conclusion that he was involved at least at some level in the cover-up, if not in the planning. And my money's on the planning aspect as well.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We've had a lot come out. And he was certainly, it's not pointed out in traditional history, and in the official story, just how perilous his legal situation was before yes. the presidency. So right. he, with you know, with the Bobby Baker scandal, who were yep. Senate aide from when he yep. was the Senate Majority Leader, kind of like mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell type guy. And he also, with Billy Celestes, his mm-hmm. partner, had gone to prison over yep. cotton allotments that didn't exist.
Right.
So, getting, you know, the scandal was pulling him in closer, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Kennedy was going to cut him as vice president in any case.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's remember that Kennedy was sort of euchred into placing Johnson on the ticket to begin with.
Right.
I mean, he was not clearly President Kennedy's first choice. And, you know, the story is that he and Bobby were in the motel room at the Democratic convention that year, and literally sweating bullets, you know, that they did not want to put him on the ticket. And they finally bowed to the pressure to do so. So, yeah, you've got the Billy Celestes business. And let's remember that Bobby, I think it was Bobby Baker, one of the two of them, either Billy Celestes or Bobby Baker, that testified in that Texas trial in the county, where in the affidavit they come right out and say that Johnson was involved.
That's Celestes, and he does.
Yeah, Billy Celestes, and then
on the record.
You've got that on record. You've got that thumbprint now from it looks to be Malcolm Wallace at the Texas School Book Depository that places him there, who was definitely a Johnson hitman.
Yes.
So, you know, there's clear indications that Johnson knew something was up and was in on the planning at some stage.
And Johnson, again, was known before he became VP as Senator NASA.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Johnson was big time on the space program. And let's remember that in Johnson's thinking, space represented the next high ground. So in other words, Johnson's whole approach to the space program from the outset was to gain military advantage. And, you know, this persisted in his views of the space program. So, yeah, he was the driving force, I think, behind all of that as well.
It's amazing when we get around the Kennedy assassination, how many threads we have that don't belong there.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the official story and some of the researchers, like you said, they'll go to things like Cubans or mafia and those uh-huh. things you could almost imagine. OK, they should be there. But the uh-huh. things that shouldn't be there are things like NASA and uh-huh. Nazis and Antarctica.
Antarctica and, you know, we were talking before the recording, the Organisation Armée Secrète in France.
Yes.
That group of right-wing French military officers that tried to stage a coup and overthrow de Gaulle and get him assassinated. Well, there was a book that came out in France. I think it was within 2 or 3 years after the assassination. De Gaulle had a study of the assassination commissioned by the Sûreté. And initially, of course, that was all classified, but then he decided to, you know, allow it to be published. So it came out in France in a book that was titled Farewell America. And the French study concluded that the OAS had some involvement at some point in the assassination. And when you say OAS, you're saying Nazis, because, you know, they're in bed with them, they're in bed with Otto Skorzeny and so on. And Robert Groden, you know, one of the famous JFK assassination researchers, did that that documentary for who was it? It wasn't Bill Kristol, thinking of somebody that came out, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and traced one of the assassinations to one of these French assassins that had been involved with, you know, the Marseille connection and all that.
Yes.
So, you know, that has always been present, but it's people have never really known how that factored in. What are all these fascists doing in this whole thing? And even Garrison stumbled across this. And of course, he didn't know what to make of it. So he goes ahead and goes after Clay Shaw, but that connection is there. So, and I do think it has a great deal to do with NASA in some form or fashion.
Absolutely. That's absolutely fascinating. The that's The Men Who Killed Kennedy. And that's it's a British director, Nigel Turner, but he used guys like Grodin and the rest. And it is interesting because he brought forward that episode, which had a lot to do with Marseille and
this
whole kind of corridor. Mm-hmm. And there was a drug aspect to it as well.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Really?
I think the key there, if you're investigating the drug aspect of it, is this is right at the beginning of an attempt to restructure the international drug trade. What's his name? Hendricks, whatever it was, that wrote the book, The Great Heroin Coup, talks about this restructuring of the drug trade that began more or less after the JFK assassination, where they're trying to wrestle it out of the hands of the French connection and reroute all of that traffic to Indochina, Latin America, and so on. And of course, that's what we see going on today. So there is that aspect of things connected to it as well. And, you know, Kennedy... I'm increasingly convinced, Daniel, that something is going on now with all of this hoopla with President Trump and so on, that whatever deep state faction is behind Trump, to me, the key here is Roy Cohn and whatever Roy Cohn may have told him about what was going on back at that time. Because you have that very weird association of Kennedy and Forrestal and McCarthy, and all three of these men end up dead, you know, and under suspicious circumstances of weird stuff going on at Bethesda Naval Hospital. No less. So, you know, there's some aspect of this I'm convinced that still has not come out about the Kennedy assassination. And, We're still trying to piece all of it together, and there's some sort of connection to this long-term factional battle that I think has been going on in this country between elements of the deep state.
Wow, it's amazing that you mentioned the Trump part there, because Trump is the kind of guy who would use this
as
holding the cards.
Yeah.
And if they really push for it, if they really try to impeach him, I can see him just going for those records and just... letting that out, and then the you know, the truth will fly if he does that. Now I do think it's interesting you point that out too. In Professor Scott's work, he talks about the deep state versus the presidency and the various assaults that they've had on the White House,
right?
And he calls the JFK assassination the first assault. But they're up to their old tricks, because this is an ongoing 3-year battle against the White House, regardless of, you know, if somebody's a Democrat or Republican or Libertarian. You can clearly see these guys are going after Trump.
Well, if we look at the presidents who've run afoul of this deep state, I think you have to look, you know, back beyond Trump. I think the next one that they do is Nixon, of course, and then Carter with the whole Iran-Contra thing.
Yeah.
You know, I was not a fan of President Carter, didn't like his policies, but, you know, he was a decent man, and he did not have the he comes in kind of like Kennedy. He comes in without his network, and he's bringing in all these trilateral people with him, and then all of a sudden he gets euchred with this Iran hostage rescue thing,
right?
That to me is, it smells to high heaven.
Yes.
So you've got that, and then you've got the assassination attempt on President Reagan.
Yes.
You know, so you've got something going on here with all these presidents that they're trying to manipulate. And you're right. It's Kennedy that begins this whole process. So we're, as far as I'm concerned, we're still living in an arc of history from JFK up to 9/11. And it's the same groups that staged that coup that are just hell-bent for leather to maintain their handle on power, regardless of which president is in office and what they want to do about it.
Right, right, absolutely. That's the interesting thing, which is the invisible power mm-hmm. that is residing there, regardless who gets in mm-hmm. the administration. But if that person in that presidential seat, even if they've gone along with certain things, like you could say in the beginning, Nixon sort of went along with this machine, mm-hmm. but by 72, he's really pulling in his own direction.
Yep.
So they want to oust him at that
point. Well, yeah, Nixon's starting to pull away from the whole globalism program.
Right.
And you can see aspects even of this carrying over in certain aspects of Carter. And you certainly see it in Reagan, not necessarily as vice president, but you certainly see it with Reagan. And it's any time you get a president trying to pull away from that power structure and set policy for themselves, number one, or number two, get rid of that power structure.
Right.
They run into trouble. So, you know, the Kennedy assassination may be ancient history to a lot of people, but the effects and the consequences and the implications of it are written all over today's news, whether we like it or not.
No question about it. And it's such an absurd thing to have as the official story things, which have just been, I mean, clearly proven to be ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that even in popular culture, things like the magic bullet or the patsy are a punchline.
Yeah.
As everyone knows. So, but yet and still, when they roll it out, you know, when they have these things out for the anniversary, they're going to roll out one of these guys and it's going to be like CIA journalist Joe Posner. And he's going to talk about how Oswald was unstable. I mean, come on.
I know. It's maintaining the narrative at all costs. And it's become, and Daniel, the problem with maintaining narratives that are complete fictions is that they become dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, Kennedy was, according to some researchers, you know, wanting to make nice with the Soviets and have a joint lunar mission. And that was yet another reason that some people theorize that he was offed. Mm-hmm. And the problem there is if you're sustaining fake narratives like that that have geopolitical implications, mm-hmm. this becomes a dangerous thing. So we better be very certain that, number one, the narratives that we believe are true, and if, in this case, it's obviously not. But imagine, had Kennedy been able to get a second term and carry through some of the policies that he wanted to carry through, the Cold War would have looked very different. The unipolar world that we see America trying to enforce and shove down everybody else's throats would have been, you know, would not have happened. So it would have been a very different country. So this is why I say the assassination may seem like ancient history to people, but it has implications for what is going on now that are simply profound, and they cannot be discounted. This is the key event that has set the United States on this course that we're trying to undo right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you see there's some attempt there in 68, when Bobby mm-hmm. Kennedy mm-hmm. tries to go into the White House mm-hmm. to get all that faction back, to get all that back. And he's wiped out before he even gets to a convention.
Right. he doesn't even get to the convention. They don't even want to take the chance with him.
Right.
And, you know, the same thing again with John Jr. There's no doubt in my mind that was an assassination mm-hmm. and expressly for the purpose of keeping him away from revealing, you know, the truth about what happened to his father. So, in other words, whatever power structure assumed control after the Kennedy assassination, the two Kennedy assassinations, whatever power structure that was, it's still there.
Right.
And it still wants to maintain its hegemony over the policy of this country. That's the problem.
Right. And in some ways, the impeachment is the legacy of some of this action.
Yeah, in my view, it is. In my view, it is. Because you have the same major players involved. You've got the clowns in America faction within America intelligence. You've got that Wall Street, you know, Sullivan and Cromwell crowd. You've got the central banks and so on and so forth. These are all up to their earlobes involvement in the Kennedy assassination. And these are what you see are the major actors right now. So to me, it's very, very important that we get this right. And as far as I'm concerned, Daniel, the people that have been getting it right are all these JFK assassination researchers, beginning way back with Harold Weisberg, you know, some of those early assassination researchers that were just absolutely pilloried by the establishment for concocting conspiracy theories and so on. But as it turns out, they were right. So, you know, this whole public narrative that we've been living under, you know, no one believes it anymore. And it's high time that we start connecting it to some of the other events that came after it.
You know, it's fascinating to think of it that way. And also, it's interesting about impeachment. I'll just say this, which is it's clear that presidents like Obama, for example, solicited things like the Steele dossier and wanted to bring that into the campaign so that Trump wouldn't have a chance.
Right.
And so he's using a foreign power to interfere with an election. So the idea that Trump's on the phone talking about Biden, and if you're going to replace him, you're going to have to retroactively go back and say that Obama shouldn't have been president for those 4 years.
Right. So, yeah, it's exactly. There's this. The thing that's worrying about this is when you look at President Kennedy and this coalescence of interests, in each case of the major factions, the Cubans, the intelligence community, the banks, and so on, the mob, every single one of those factions individually has some sort of international connection.
Right.
So in other words, you've got it really... What's behind all of this is an international cabal. Well, fast forward to 9/11 and the aftermath of 9/11. You've got Sergei Glazyev inside of Russia saying, well, you know, 9/11 was the product of an international cabal. And Tatiana Koryagina, the economist writing in Pravda, it's a cabal with assets in excess of $300 trillion that are trying to steer the globe the way they want it to go.
Yeah.
And Glazyev and his comments, well, we don't have to worry about the Nazis in Kiev. Our problem is the Nazis in Washington. You know,
that's putting it where it is.
That's putting it where it is, yeah. But the essence of these comments is what the Russians are saying is that they're not dealing with a state actor. They're dealing with something international, and it's truly a kind of a cabal. And when you turn the wheel back to Kennedy, what do you find? Well, you've got all of these interests involved in his assassination, and they've got international connections. So the other thing they're really worried about Kennedy, I think, is that even though Kennedy oftentimes talks a long globalist game, in point of fact, his policies are rather populist in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, along comes Donald Trump and here we are. You know?
That global game, if you're not on board, you're going to have problems.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's interesting. Let's look at one of those factors around the Kennedy assassination that Jim Garrison got into, which is Permadex. You wrote about Permadex in your book, and you've when we've done interviews on it, you've spelled them out really well. What's fascinating is how little they are covered, in a sense, even in the JFK assassination world. There's not, you know, it's funny that they are kind of marginalized, and I think it's largely a language thing, which is so much of the material about them comes out in this French language publications by French authors in Quebec. So I think there's a gap there in our knowledge. But so the Permadex largely comes up first in the Garrison investigation and then in something called the Torbid document,
right, which
basically be like the 1970 version of WikiLeaks.
Yeah, it really was. It was the comparison to WikiLeaks is very apt, I think. This document, for people that don't know, is a document that was compiled by an attorney in the state of Texas, in South Texas, that was part of the Lyndon Johnson machine, incidentally, that basically tried to summarize all of the stuff in the Garrison files that didn't make it into the trial of Clay Shaw.
Right.
And, you know, and it's true. Garrison was uncovering a mountain of details, and you can just imagine a district attorney in New Orleans scratching his head, trying to figure out, well, how's NASA involved in this? And we've got all of these World Trade Centers, you know, being yes. built around the world, and that are fronts for the CIA. What the heck is going on here? You know, yeah. And the way I look at it, increasingly, and I just came to this conclusion within the last couple of weeks thinking about all of this again, that these Permandex World Trade Center corporations, this front corporation that's set up with some very unusual people on the board, you know, Bloomfield, Bronfman, you know, all of these people.
Yeah.
To literally, as far as the Torbit document's concerned, conduct assassinations of people that, you know, are standing in the way of their goals, whatever those are.
Right.
I suspect now strongly that this was the early manifestation of corporate fronts being established by the intelligence community in this country and other countries for the express purpose of laundering and moving money around in what I've been calling that hidden system of finance. Mm-hmm. So when Kennedy determines to shut down the CIA and turn all of its covert operations over to the Pentagon, he's doing two things. I used to think that, well, the reason the Nazis are involved in this is when he's shutting down the CIA, he's shutting down the front behind which they're operating.
Right.
But the second reason, if you accept this hypothesis that this Permandex World Trade Center structure is somehow plugged into this hidden system of finance and the big central banks and the big prime banks in the West, which I have no doubt that it was, if you accept that thesis, then Kennedy is actually taking aim at another group as well. And that's this whole international intelligence cabal
right.
that's in business running all of these scams and schemes for their own profit. And he effectively is going to shut that down as well, because what is that? That's a covert op, and he's going to turn it over to the Pentagon.
Right.
You know, this is another big problem. Yeah. And then the final nail in the coffin in that argument is, okay, in June of 1963, he publishes that executive order stating that, okay, we're going to print up $4 billion worth of United States notes, bypass the Federal Reserve completely,
yeah.
and circulate debt-free money. You know, yeah. shades of Abraham Lincoln. So, yeah.
he's moving almost on every front.
Yeah.
And he's lining up his enemies together. Mm-hmm. Even if they have disagreements with each other, they're like, we all agree that this guy has to go.
Well, stop and think again. If John Kennedy had a second term, and you're part of this deep state cabal, and you're watching all of these policy decisions, you know, up to and including this executive order about United States notes, you've got to be thinking, oh my God, he's coming after us all.
Yeah.
And we can't let this guy get a second term with Bobby as the U.S. Attorney General, because, oh my God, they could come after all of us and throw us in jail. Who does that sound like?
Yeah, right.
So, and it's interesting, you know, just before we started, Daniel, since we're on the topic of yeah. comparisons here, I read an article that somebody had sent me that the reason that President Trump had recently gone to Walter Reed Army Hospital, ostensibly for physical, you know, checkup and so on, was yeah. because his food taster had suddenly shown very bad symptoms.
Oh.
And now, you know, this is the latest internet rumor. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's worth mentioning going out there that there may have been an assassination attempt through poison food, you know, so we're back with the Borgias.
You know? Yeah, right, right. Oh, I wouldn't put it past them to go that route with Trump. That's kind of
I wouldn't either.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because they did confirm that the visit to Walter Reed was unscheduled and an unnatural way that it had gone. So we know that for a fact.
Right.
And it is unusual, I think.
Mm-hmm. It is.
But it's just the fact that he has his own security force and he likes to use them along with the Secret Service is probably a pretty good idea, considering if we look at Kennedy's Secret Service stand down that takes place at the airport before he gets there. Obviously, there should have been two guys on the back of the limousine.
Oh, sure. Of course there should have been.
Yes.
And you can even see in some of the documentaries, you can see that one Secret Service agent who's been told, no, you're not supposed to. And he's turning around like, what the heck?
Yes.
You know?
Right.
And the real question you can just kind of see percolating in his mind was, who gave that order?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know who my suspicion is, and he's riding with Senator Yarborough a few limos back.
Vice President there, yeah.
The Vice President, yeah.
He seems to duck a little bit early in the whole
thing.
Let's not forget. One of the things I find interesting, and we're going to jump into Permandex, but since you mentioned the Secret Service there, is there's a Secret Service agent who set up the route.
Yes.
And we always knew that the route had issues.
Oh, big time.
Major issues. That you just wouldn't plan in terms of security the way that it looped around and it stopped 11 miles an hour and all the rest.
No.
So he set up the route, and then we found out through records that did come out in 2017, because remember, they were all supposed to come out in 2017 and didn't. Only some of them did. But we found out that the mayor who helped him set that up and who was riding in the motorcade, Mayor Cabal, or Cabal.
Cabal.
He was the brother of Charles Cabal.
Yep.
Who was Dulles' deputy. But it was not known before that he was a CIA asset himself.
Yes.
That's something that came out in those records. And again, that instantly opens our eyes about what was happening there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Under no circumstances in normal security procedures would you have had an approval to take that right angle turn off of Main onto Houston and then a left-hand right angle turn onto Elm in front of the school book depository precisely because it slows the limo down too much.
Right.
And the original route was to go straight through Dealey Plaza and not make that little jog that was actually made on the day of the assassination. So yeah, their fingerprints are all over this thing any way one slices it. And I'll tell you the real eye opener for me, I'll never forget this. And I even put it, I think, in that book, was as my family, my dad smoking his pipe and swearing like a sailor about this narrative that was being concocted in front of our eyes. I'll never forget this. Walter Cronkite read a statement by Victor Zorin, who, you know, you can see Walter Cronkite taking off his glasses and just getting real upset that, you know, the communist shill and propagandist Victor Zorin has come out and said. And basically, and Zorin, incidentally, was the Soviet UN ambassador that you see Adlai Stevenson, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
Victor Zorin is the Soviet ambassador.
Translation Zorin.
Yeah, no way, no need to wait for translations, Mr. Zorin. But anyway, when the assassination happened, Victor Zorin came out and made a statement to Pravda that to anyone who knows the protocols of security for major world leaders, something to this effect, there is no way that you can look at this and determine anything other than that the security around the president on the day of the assassination was not up to par. In other words, he's calling out the security stripping for all to see.
Yes.
And, you know, Cronkite has to diss this because it happens that weekend. I remember it happens that weekend mm-hmm. of the assassination. And you can actually go on YouTube and see him reading this.
Mm-hmm. It's a strange moment. I have seen that book.
Yeah.
It's almost unnerving because Cronkite is sort of giving... he's sort of saying the truth, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. He's
reading it, but it's from a Soviet propagandist.
Right? And therefore, you know, shoot the messenger, diss the message, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, in case anyone else starts thinking about it.
Well, my dad, when he heard that, he said, pardon me here, but my dad said, damn right, you know. And he was no friend of the Soviets.
If you there's another weird Cronkite thing that you've pointed out a couple of times that I think it's in the book, which is Cronkite starts talking about the reports that a different gun was used.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The initial reports when you watch the coverage of that day, and there's actually a documentary out, I forget what it's called, Evidence of Revision is what it's called. And it's nothing. It's straight presentation without any commentary whatsoever. You just watch the news on CBS, NBC, and ABC as it's being reported. And Cronkite is, and all the other networks are reporting, well, it's a 7.62 Mauser.
Right.
Mauser, Mauser, Mauser.
German.
Yeah, German. And Cronkite even says, oh, yeah, it's a Mauser, you know. It's a German sharpshooter's rifle, you know, and everybody's supposed to, ooh, you know. And then about 2 hours later, Cronkite makes the first correction announcement. We've been reporting a Mauser, and apparently it's an Italian carbine, a Mannlicher Carcanto, and he even mispronounces it. A 6.5 Italian Mannlicher Carcanto. And here's the problem with the weapon. I do believe it was a Mauser because Deputy Craig saw this. The Dallas police and sheriff's deputies that were there all saw Mauser. Well, the problem is a 7.62 Mauser was never a weapon that was actually used by the German army in World War II. It was a much bigger caliber weapon. The 7.62 version was a version that the Mauser company sold to Argentina.
Right. And it's 7.65. Yeah.
I'm sorry, 7.65. You're right.
But it is, that's the point that you're making is absolutely right on, which is that's not even a German version. That is an Argentinian version.
Golly, nothing suspicious. And, you know, and again, I'm one of these people that kind of like Richard Hoagland and some others believes that people behind these types of events also signal their presence in a certain way. And, you know, Dealey Plaza with all of its Masonic associations, the Three Tramps and all of this. But why is it that the two weapons that were fingered as assassination weapons were weapons that can be associated with the Axis powers of World War II? I mean, the only thing we're missing here are the Japanese.
Right, yeah. Just to complete the entire...
Just to complete the picture, you know. But, yeah, that's a little signal in my estimation because there are some definite Argentina connections with the New Orleans aspect of the story. So, you know, again... The fingers have been pointing at certain players, but then there are players behind the players. And I do think that de Gaulle's study that was done in France with, you know, targeting the OAS as being somehow involved and all these other things, I think there's some sort of fascist international connection to all of this. It's always been there, and they just don't know what to do with.
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating that you bring that up. De Gaulle himself had almost been removed.
Oh, yes.
By the same group. In
right, right.
He set up kind of a phony coup and all the rest. But he smoked that out and survived.
Yes.
Unlike Kennedy. But seeing Kennedy go down, he instantly, you know, the light bulb goes on. It's the same guys. Mm-hmm. There's another interesting thing about that book, which is there's a version of it that comes out in the 70s And Jacqueline Kennedy, who's working in publishing, helps to get a translation of that into
English. Yes.
So I guess that tells us a lot about what she had in mind. About.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind that Jacqueline Kennedy probably did a lot of private research on her own.
Yeah.
About it. And, you know, in that in turn, probably shared it with John Jr. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt in my mind that all of this is connected. And the other part of this that I think, as far as Jacqueline's part of the story goes, is her sudden, very weird marriage to Aristotle Onassis. You know, no fascist connections there. But, but you know, I thought at the time, this is very peculiar. And as a private speculation, I've always entertained the idea that she may have done that simply as a way of learning information. It would be something that someone like her would do, you know, to trace things down and find out where the players were and keep it to herself. But there's no doubt in my mind, you know, she was involved in that book translation from that French book. And there's no doubt in my mind that this played heavily on John's determination eventually to run for office.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because while she's married to Onassis, his son goes down in a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. later, John Jr. goes down in a plane.
In a plane. Yes, exactly. Oh, well, we all know who is connected to Aristotle Onassis.
Yes.
Hjalmar Schacht.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's and just a little outline on Schacht.
Well, Schacht was Hitler's banker. He was president of the Reichsbank between the wars and deeply, deeply connected. So, and he pops up after the war in just weird places like Egypt during the overthrow of King Farouk by the CIA, you know, which, again, you dig into the details. And, yeah, it may have been the CIA, but the people on the ground doing all the overthrowing of King Farouk were a bunch of Nazis.
Right. Yeah.
But and he shows up in Indonesia with Sukarno, you know, at all these weird times and places. So, it just doesn't get any better. So, yeah, you're dealing with an international cabal here that off President Kennedy.
Let's look at the German contingent around NASA.
Okay.
And there's a push-pull there between Kennedy and NASA, and strange things start to happen. One of the things that you've pointed out, which is that von Braun, who we get over there, who was the head of the rocket program of the Nazis, when we get him, he's making rockets for us, and one of the things that he demands is, I want my team back.
Uh-huh.
I want my command structure back.
Uh-huh.
So by the time he gets to NASA, he's got his old Nazi team back.
Oh, he's got it completely back. He's the one that brought over General Dornberger.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that insisted that they bring over Hermann Oberth. And you talk about a Looney Tunes guy.
Yeah.
It was Dr. Oberth. He's bringing all these people over so that by... And this was not my observation. This was actually a lady's observation by the name of Linda Hunt,
uh-huh.
Who's writing about all these Nazi rocket scientists. And her observation was that by 1948, 49, thereabouts, that this group of German rocketeers had basically been able to reproduce the exact command structure within the American defense industrial complex that they had in Nazi Germany. And, you know, it's telling that one of the individuals that ends up as the senior flight administrator during Project Apollo is Dr. Kurt Davis, one of these Nazis. And he was a Nazi Nazi. I mean,
right, yeah.
You know, there wasn't, I'm going along with this for the ride sort of thing. No, he denounced one of his fellow scientists in Germany to the Gestapo at one point, which caused his whole security record to be reviewed in this country once that became known, mm-hmm. which incidentally happened after Roswell for some reason. Yeah. So, you've got this whole Nazi command structure, and it got so bad, Daniel, that at one point, James Webb, the Kennedy's and Johnson's director of NASA, had to step in and intervene with the Germans in NASA. Do you know why? Because Arthur Rudolph, the guy that basically helps design the Saturn V booster, was so fed up with how slow the American contractual process worked that he was talking openly to the rest of his German buddies, let's just build this dang thing in-house and forget all of these corporations. We can get it done in 2 years. And Webb had to go in and shut them down because they were planning just to go ahead and do this on their on their own.
If you want a secret space program,
yeah. If you want a secret space program, here you go. So, there's all sorts of stuff going on. And if Webb is doing that, then my suspicion is word of it gets back to Kennedy, gets back to Johnson, and, you know, they shut it down. So, again, you've got all of these interests gunning for Kennedy, literally.
Absolutely. And you've mentioned other things about those German scientists acting autonomously, mm-hmm. Shooting off rockets in the desert.
Hitting Mexico.
The great American attack on Mexico.
Yes, the great American rocket attack on Mexico, courtesy of the Nazi party. But they did. You know, yes. It's a matter of record.
Yes.
Yeah, they did. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. But you mentioned, it's interesting because one of the things that they have going on is they are suddenly, it seems like, living in this lavish style. They're shooting off their own kind of rocket tests, and now they're planning to do their own space program. So there are people inside our government who are starting to wonder, what's going on? Like, how is this happening?
Well, the Torbit document is very interesting because it mentions something that's very peculiar, that's next to impossible to find anything out about. The Torbit document mentions that as part of the covert aspects of the secret space program, they established what was known as DISC, D-I-S-C, which stands for Defense Industrial Security Command.
Right.
Which was totally under the control of Wernher von Braun.
Right. Yes.
Call him a Nazi, he won't even frown. Nazi schmatzi, says Wernher von Braun. But anyway, this entity, you know, you don't run across other than in this document. But I think it plugs into what you just mentioned about these German rocket scientists, because after Roswell, and again, this sets off a security review of these Nazi scientists, especially of Dr. Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we're never told a reason why this happens, other than Army counterintelligence somehow learns that Davis had denounced one of his fellow scientists to the Gestapo in 1942. So Davis's whole file is vetted again, and apparently he passed because he ends up as a senior flight director for Project Apollo.
You're right.
And ultimately ends up in control of NASA's UFO files.
Yeah. Yeah.
another little problematic, but anyway, when the Army starts going back into these scientists' files, they discover that how are these Nazis affording their nice limousine Mercedes on the salary that the United States Army is paying them? They're all driving Mercedes, and they all appear to have, and this again is from the Army counterintel, they all appear to have some sort of dead drop in Mexico.
Okay.
And they appear to be communicating outside of the American, so my suspicion, and I'm sharing this wild speculation for the first time, my suspicion has always been that this Defense Industrial Security Command may have been kind of an ad hoc name that these Nazis were giving to their own counterintelligence efforts to maintain their secrecy and whatever connection they had overseas. Now, my suspicion is that that connection is via the Bolivar shortwave radio network that Walter Schellenberg, the head of the Sicherheitsdienst during the war, had set up in Latin America and in Mexico and Middle America. So this is my suspicion, that this may have been some sort of Nazi counterintelligence ad hoc group that was formed as these Nazis were getting their money from wherever they were getting their money from to buy their nice Mercedes, their Mercedes cars on army salaries, no less. Nothing suspicious here. Move along, folks.
It's the Bilderberg dividend.
Yes, it's the Bilderberg dividends. Yes. Thank you, Dr. Ops.
It is interesting, the name itself, DISC.
Yeah.
D-I-S-C.
Mm-hmm.
That gets us immediately into your
into.
Yeah. It's undeniable. One thing that's interesting about DISC, as it's suggested in the Torbett document, is that Guy Bannister is a part of it.
Yes.
Now, this is interesting because Bannister is the original X-Files guy for the FBI.
Yep.
FBI chief out of Chicago originally. Yeah. But when he's doing the UFO cases, he's in the Northwest. He's in Oregon.
Boise.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, and there are newspaper reports of him, like, with a down, you know, looking for a down saucer, and they have pictures of him talking to witnesses and things like that. And he comes up with Security Matter X, which is where all that X-Files stuff comes from in the FBI. Mm-hmm. By the time we see him in Garrison's investigation, he's already dead, but he's been sort of putting out Oswald on the street as a Cuban agitator and as an anti-Castro, a pro-Castro agitator.
Right.
And he's also, you know, infiltrating groups, pretending to be a communist and all the rest of it. And Garrison goes through this process where he sees some of the pamphlets that he's handing out, and he finds out that, oh, that's the same address as Guy Bannister.
Yes.
And the interesting thing about that is that when they dig through witnesses there, they find people who connect Bannister with Oswald.
Yes.
Bannister, Mr. Right-wing UFO guy, with Oswald, Mr. pro-communist, supposedly Marxist, pro-Castro guy. Doesn't add up.
No.
So interesting that Bannister shows up in the Torbett document as somebody who is on the board there working on DISC.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at that for a minute. Bannister, I have no doubt, was more connected than most JFK assassination research either admits or likes to look at. And there's a simple reason I think this, because when Oswald is in New Orleans, one of the things he starts bragging about is that he's going to get a job pretty soon with NASA.
Yes.
And he had applied to the Riley Coffee Company, which is another one of these, you know, intelligence fronts.
Right.
That people apply to, and then all of a sudden they end up getting jobs at NASA. You know? Right. So I'm wondering, what exactly does caffeine have to deal with rocket fuel? But, you know. But Bannister, the interesting thing about Bannister, and I strongly suspect this is why he was ultimately offed under some suspicious circumstances, is that he kept all of his files there in New Orleans, in his office. And when he died, his wife records that all of a sudden all of these trucks show up at their home and they clean out all of his filing cabinets.
Yeah.
My suspicion has always been that Bannister kept duplicates of all of his FBI reports on UFOs. that he was probably involved in some capacity or connection for vetting people that were making UFO sighting reports and so on and so forth. So he would be, in that sense, he would be plugged into that whole disc operation, which also, if you look at it a certain way, might be the earliest attempt to of the intelligence community to keep their hands on the narrative of what's going on and who's doing it, because that would also fall under the aegis of counterintelligence operations. So I think Bannister is a much more important figure than has hitherto been made out to be, simply for that reason. Most people think of him as, well, he shared an office with Lee Harvey Oswald in the French Quarter, you know.
Right, yeah.
No, there's a lot more going on there.
A right winger.
And a right winger, yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting, actually, when you think about it that way. They would need to grab those records, because if you have Kennedy people sort of around that stuff and it gets public at all, files or UFO files, it's a huge problem.
It's a huge problem. And the other aspect of this problem by the time of the Kennedy administration is supposedly all that UFO governmental watchdog stuff is supposed to be being conducted by the Air Force, not the FBI.
Right.
And let's remember something else about where Bannister's office was located that Oliver Stone brings out brilliantly in his movie JFK, when he has Costner going down to where Bannister's office is and taking his aide-de-camp or whatever he is on a little tour of all of the federal agencies within walking distance of Bannister's office. Yeah. The ONI.
Yeah.
Little things like that.
The Secret Service.
The Secret Service, precisely. So there's definitely something else going on here. And the fact that ONI, particularly, you know, in that area, with its rumored connections to the whole UFO thing, with Oswald having been a Marine and, you know, all of this stuff, and on we could go. So, yeah, I think Bannister as a member of the board of DISC at first glance sounds nutty, but when you probe it a little bit, it begins to start to make sense.
Well, here's another nutty one. Who else goes up?
Yeah, you can't make this stuff up, folks. He couldn't write a movie this bad. It's like a soap opera, but go ahead.
Roy Cohn shows up in the Torvet document.
Yes, he does.
So what does lead us through that one?
How does the original swamp creature show up? Well, look, I just did that McCarthy book, McCarthy, Monmouth and the Deep State.
Yes.
That to this day, I'm just gobsmacked that those transcripts contain what they do.
They mention, as you point out, Project Blue Book in
McCarthy
transcripts.
Well, they not only mention that, but repeatedly there are mentions of the date of July of 1947 and New Mexico and just little things like that. and you can tell that when Cohn and McCarthy are questioning these witnesses, they are doing their level best to be as direct as they can without mentioning the R word, Roswell. You can just tell. Because the details in those aspects of the transcripts are just too much. So there's Roy Cohn, the original swamp creature, that is now looking at not only communist infiltration in the government, but all of a sudden into things that connect to the UFO program, to secret research at Fort Monmouth, to atomic artillery, all of this stuff. And, you know, again, let's connect dots here. Who is President Trump closely associated with at one point of his life? Roy Cohn.
Yes.
So again, Roy Cohn being Roy Cohn, you can just kind of imagine the quid pro quos going on in those conversations. Well, tell me about what you know about Jack Kennedy, or tell me what you know about my uncle, you know, that worked at MIT. And Cohn says, well, what's in it for me? Right. And they strike some sort of deal, and Cone gives them the info.
Yeah.
Which, as far as the Monmouth transcripts are concerned, aren't declassified until 2003. So, you know, Trump may have had inside information on all this goings on for a very, very long time, and I wouldn't be surprised.
Which would give him an incredible leg up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Some incredible leverage. And if they, if the same cabal, if the same factions of this deep state as were behind President Kennedy suspect that, let's parse my words carefully. If they even suspect something like that has transacted at a certain point in President Trump's career, they're going to be awfully, awfully scared of the man and try to do anything they can to bring him down and retain control over that aspect, that big squatting UFO aspect of the narrative.
Absolutely.
Wow, incredible. Joseph, thank you. Amazing information. Now in part two, we'll go even deeper and reveal the Permindex link to modern corporate and political corruption and the ongoing struggle to obtain the Bloomfield papers from the Canadian Library Archives. The papers that reveal close connections between Permindex founder Louis Bloomfield, the CIA, and former President George Bush Sr. Subscribers will get that episode directly in their inbox next week. Now's the time to subscribe at darkjournalist.com. And of course, Joseph's work is available at GizaDeathStar.com. Joseph, stay right there and let's get into part two. Now, please join us every week for the X series, Friday nights at 8 p.m. in 2020. And remember, on the JFK assassination anniversary of 56 years and still no answers, we will get those answers. See you soon.